This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. So you're wondering what the future will look like? Try female. Almost 40% of married women in the U.S. now earn higher salaries than their husbands, a number that has skyrocketed in recent decades. And women continue to build impressive careers, routinely racking up more degrees than men. So the question is, how might this change the country and the world? Are we entering an era of stay-at-home dads or of marriages that are really strained over finances? Could our social future look so radically different that it would floor our parents? Joining me to answer these questions is Liza Mundy, author of The Richer Sex, How the New Majority of Female Breadwinners is Transforming Sex, Love, and Family. She's also a fellow at the New America Foundation. Liza Mundy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let me start with this issue of degrees. Already, women out-earn men when it comes to bachelor's degrees. Women hold more master's degrees than men. And you say in your book that by 2050, demographers predict that there will be 140 educated women for every 100 college-educated men. That is a huge gap. And I'm wondering, how did we get here?
Yeah, so there, and as you say, what's interesting is that this is taking place all over the world. I mean, not only in our country and not only in other developed countries like the UK and Canada and much of Europe, but in many developing countries around the world and also, say, Japan and South Korea. So it's really a global trend. And, you know, there are states like Alaska where that those proportions are already in place, you know, 150 women in college for every 100 men. And there's a constellation of reasons for this. In the middle of the last century, men had incentives to go to college that women didn't have. They had the GI Bill. During the Vietnam War, they had draft deferments that also propelled men into college. Those incentives, have abated, whereas women, starting in the 1970s, they had campuses opening up to them that had not been opened up before, so they had new opportunities to go to college. They began to see, interestingly, economists have shown that when the pill came on the landscape and women understood that they could have a career that would be less likely to be interrupted by an unplanned pregnancy, that they started envisioning their future differently and they started, you know, laying the groundwork to have careers and going to college. So they reached parity, numerical parity in the 1980s, and they have been outpacing men ever since. And there's also a lot of research showing that in elementary school and in high school, you know, girls are getting higher grades. They're more focused. They're more likely to do their homework. In the early years where school is more academic than it's ever been before, they're sort of really getting a head start. So there are a lot, interestingly enough, you know, parents are giving girls the message, you need to be able to support yourself someday. At some point in your adult life, you'll be supporting yourself. And in order to do that well, you need a college degree. I mean, men used to sort of look out at a world in which it was plausible that you could get a decent paying industrial manufacturing job with a high school degree, but women have really never enjoyed that reality. They've always needed more education, even in order to do as well as men financially. So they've gotten into the college going habit more so than men have. And studies also show that parents are more likely to pay for a girl's college education than for sons.
Interesting. I mean, I guess I wonder, normally we see when there's a trend and the pendulum swings very far in one direction, whether it's, let's say, the government becomes very liberal or very conservative, it might swing back. But this trend just seems to continue and exacerbate, and men don't seem to be changing the way that they're approaching college, master's degrees, that kind of thing, in order to deal with it. Do you see at some point, well, okay, this trend is going to abate instead of becoming 120 educated women for every 100 men, 140, 160? What's gonna shift the pendulum?
Yeah, that is a really good question. Schools could change, I suppose, to accommodate if boys have different learning styles or, you know, need more time to run around or whatever. I mean, schools could change a bit. parents could start sending a message to their son. One study that was done in Alaska showed that particularly boys from working class families were pressured by their families to go out and get a job after high school, and in some cases were told, say, by their brothers that that office work and white collar employment was fruity. So if there's this kind of macho attitude that boys are hearing, or if they're being pressured, ironically enough, pressured to go out and start earning as soon as they can, out of high school to get a job, then I think the message they hear from their communities and families could change. Interestingly enough, in my book, I interviewed a couple in Deep South Texas, a Latina woman and her husband, and she had always been very pushed by her family to go to college. She had done so. She'd gotten a master's. She was working for her local member of Congress, very dynamic, very motivated, about to start work on her PhD. Her husband had really not been encouraged by his family to go to college. He had had to drop out in order to get jobs. And it was really her inspiration and example that ultimately encouraged him to go back and get his college degree. So he was looking to her for inspiration. And I mean, this may be a little optimistic, but that's one thing that I hope could happen. I mean, if young women are setting this example for young men, in some cases, I talked to women who were basically marrying guys who didn't go to college and then making them go to college. So maybe, up to a certain point, maybe influence from family and loved ones could have an impact.
I'm Kara Miller. This is Boston Public Radio. We're talking with Liza Mundy, author of The Richer Sex, How the New Majority of Female Breadwinners is Transforming Sex, Love, and Family. And let's talk about that issue of family here, because I'm very interested in how money affects society. And one of the things that you do in the book is you really look at what is this future going to look like. Right now, we have almost 40% of U.S. wives out earning their husbands. Women have 51% of managerial and professional jobs in the U.S. How does the issue of money change the dynamic in families?
Yes, and I should say it's 40% of working wives who are out earning their husbands. But most wives in sort of working age are working wives. And what's interesting about that statistic is it includes women who work full time, part time, and who are self employed.
I should say you point out in the book that in 1970, the percentage of wives, working wives, who out earned their husbands was in the low single digits. So that the rise has been enormous.
Right. And I mean, it's, it plays out in any number of ways. In some cases, if it comes as a surprise to a couple, if the woman starts pulling ahead in her career, it can be disorienting for a man who feels like he's not fulfilling his traditional breadwinner's role. It can be even more disorienting for the wife in the partnership or a single woman in a relationship who didn't really expect this. I mean, what's interesting is I think most women, I think it's safe to say, have been raised to think, parity is our goal, a world of sort of exact equality. We're working the same number of hours as men. We're getting paid, the same wage as men. And when we go home, we're doing the same amount of housework and the same, number of chores. And so when women find themselves pulling ahead and pulling ahead of their partner and doing better on some level, it can come as a surprise and it can be disconcerting sometimes to women. But I guess ultimately, to me, the message is it is a good thing for women to be economically empowered in their relationships. I mean, we know that in the 1970s, when women started working and earning, men started doing more work around the house. So, economists have shown that women got more bargaining power in their relationships when they started earning. And ultimately, I would argue that we're moving into a world where couples can trade back and forth. And if you're a working couple with children and you feel like it's easier for one person to be doing the bulk of the earning and one person to be doing sort of more of the caregiving, that gender will not matter so much in terms of deciding who does that work. I mean, it's interesting that economists have shown that early on in relationships, couples make decisions looking at who has more earning potential. And it used to be that a woman knew that if she was going to face wage discrimination and her salary would be lower than her husband's, they would make a decision early on that she'd be the one maybe to stay home. And so in my book, I interview couples that have made basically the reverse decision, where young men have looked at their girlfriends and said, you know what, you are doing awesome in this PhD engineering program, and you've had great internships, and you're going to get great job offers. So let's privilege your career, and I'll move for your sake. And if you get a job offer in California, and we're in Atlanta right now, I'll move with you. And you know, sometimes young women can be taken aback when a man says this to them. But I would argue that having a supportive partner gives women more leverage in the workplace and will enable them, you know, to raise their salaries and to be taken even more seriously as employees.
Do you think we're entering a world potentially with quite a bit more stay-at-home dads?
Well, yeah, we have seen those numbers, I think, basically double. I mean, it's still a small percentage of fathers, but it is certainly a population that's growing. I mean, you see it a lot in popular culture and media now, men, you know, pushing strollers and carrying babies and snugglies. And I think you do see that much more in the world at large. We're not being inundated by stay-at-home fathers, but it is a growing population, and it is, I say, an increasingly vocal population. I mean, you know, there are advocacy groups now for stay-at-home dads and support groups.
So let me veer off from this a little and challenge you on one thing. We do see, as you say, women rising up through the ranks of education. But one thing we don't see is women getting to the very top. And I wonder what's coming there. I'm going to play you a little clip from Liz Clayman from Fox Business Network. And I talked to her not that long ago about going to the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. She had just come back, and she said that historically there have been so few women there because so few women run governments, run companies, that they actually had to institute a quota. And I had I interviewed her the same morning that I interviewed Marissa Mayer, who has just become CEO of Yahoo. So let's listen to what Liz Clayman had to say.
On one hand, I would love to believe that it's a meritocracy, but apparently that just isn't working. Okay, so what do I mean by that? There are hardly any women at Davos. It's gotten better in the past couple of years, but Davos and the organizers finally got to the point where they said, left to your own devices, you corporations are still not bringing women along with your teams. Now, the way Davos works is you pay a certain fee and you get to bring 5 to 10 people. Klaus Schwab of Davos basically started to say, one of those people at least has got to be a woman now, or don't bother coming. And when forced to do it that way, they found a lot of great candidates to bring along. I noticed it this year.
Liza Mundy, author of The Richer Sex. Why are women ascending but not ascending to the top?
Right. I mean, and it's, you know, everybody wishes that they could answer that question. And I've had any number of conversations with women about this and why different professions are more hospitable to women than others. For example, women are, you know, they're flipping certain fields in medicine. They're, you know, finding their way and coming to be a majority in a number of medical fields, in law as well. Business has been less hospitable. Wall Street has been less hospitable. So why is it? Why are some professions more hospitable than others, I think, is an open question and one that I've had a lot. I think quotas are, you know, definitely something to talk about. I mean, it's always anathema in our country when you talk about quotas. But I've talked to women who work on Wall Street, women who work in the world of banking, who do think that quotas will be, are an important way of getting women to the top. I mean, I do argue in my book that when we have more stay-at-home dads, when we have more supportive partners and men who are willing to move for their wife's career and facilitate her career, that too is something that will enable women to rise to the top. I mean, you know, maybe they're going to have to work a long workday, but it certainly will be helpful. I mean, we're in this really interesting situation right now, and it does sort of harken back to the political campaign because you do hear conversations about this. The president talks about the fact that more and more women are breadwinners in their families. We know this. And yet there is still, you know, overall a wage gap. And so what you have is women supporting families and supporting households on salaries that are lower than a man's would be. And the question is how to address this.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because in the second debate, we heard that much thought about and reviewed question that Mitt Romney said, when I was governor of Massachusetts, I looked for people who were qualified women. None applied. But when I contacted women's groups, they brought me women full of binders. I wonder what your take was on that answer and the kind of attention it got.
Oh, yeah, that was fascinating. I mean, in a way, I was sorry to see the sort of instant Twitter kind of takes on binders of women, that it became a joke so quickly, because I felt at least initially that he was talking about, in a way, he was talking about affirmative action. He was talking about inclusion. He probably wasn't talking about quotas, but he was talking about getting beyond your initial applicant set and reaching out and making an effort to include other people. I think, you know, eventually it emerged that those binders had been presented to him by women's groups who were trying to, you know, to get women to be considered for top office. So it wasn't so much that he was reaching out as he was having it presented to him. But the fact that the conversation was going on about making an effort to be more inclusive. I mean, I've talked to women in the banking world who've argued, I think convincingly, you know, that this is a world that sort of runs on deal making and hanging out with people you feel comfortable with and people who are like you. And so it's the, you know, it's the unlike employees and professionals who don't get the same consideration. And I think, you know, finding ways to force the system to hire people who aren't exactly like you and who are outside your comfort zone, it's a really important conversation to keep having.
Yeah, and actually to that point, I talked to Judy Shen-Fillerman, who is the founder of DreamBridge Partners, and she talked about this idea of sort of having a male model for the CEO and making people, even though the world has changed, try to accommodate that model. So let's listen to her.
Maybe there are more ways to have women that are in. So I really do challenge for all of us to use the word opt out. What I say is that companies have not allowed women and those that choose to have a different lifestyle to opt in. And therefore, it is a great loss on the part of corporate America to not be maintaining those with the highest talent. So then what you're left with is those that are willing to deal with this kind of perspective of ascension and power.
Liza Mundy, are we dealing with a situation in which some of the really talented people do opt out because there's still a sort of old school model for what leadership at the top looks like?
Well, yes. And I think, again, I've had conversations with top women in the banking world who made the argument, for example, that when women are envisioning themselves into a higher position and applying for, say, a job that would be higher than the one they have, that women sometimes will kind of focus on, say they're 40%, say they're 60% qualified for the job. They'll focus on sort of the 40% where they're not. And whereas men will come in and do what, one woman I spoke to called sell the gap, you know, just sort of ignore that 40% where they are, where they fall short and make the case for why they can do this job. And I think there are all sorts of reasons. I mean, maybe corporate America still envisions the top CEO as a man, but maybe women, when they are making their own way through the workforce, need to be more assertive and expand their sense of possibility and what they're capable of and sell the gap, as this one executive put it.
We're talking about how the future could be shaped and influenced by women. And when we come back, I want to talk about sex, social implications, and the view from abroad. I'm speaking with Liza Mundy, author of The Richer Sex, How the New Majority of Female Breadwinners is Transforming Sex, Love, and Family. I'm Kara Miller, and the conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio. This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. If you're just joining us, we're talking about how the role of women is changing and changing radically from their careers to their earning power. And I'm joined by Liza Mundy, author of The Richer Sex, How the New Majority of Female Breadwinners is Transforming Sex, Love, and Family. And Liza Mundy, let's talk about the issue of sex for a minute. A couple really interesting things from the book that I noted. One is, you describe kind of a new world for sex, and this may be because of some of the imbalance on campuses we talked about before, women outnumbering men on college campuses more and more. But you quote data from a national survey of family growth, and they found in 2008 that almost 29% of women and about 29% of men from 15 to 24 had reported having no sexual contact with any other person ever. And that was up quite a bit from 22% in 2002. Is this mismatch on college campuses having a real profound impact, not just on education, but on social issues?
Yeah, I think it's having a complicated impact. I mean, one of the reasons that I wrote this book was I had been interested for quite some time in this, you know, this flip on campuses in numbers. I mean, I went to college back in the 1980s, where on a Northeastern campus where women were, you know, still in the minority 3-1. And probably 6 or 7 years ago, you started reading about, well, the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, UVA, William and Mary, these big public universities going, you know, becoming 55% female, 57% female. And I really wondered what that was like for the women on campus and then for them in their careers going forward. And I do think there's a complicated set of factors going on. The numbers that you just quoted suggest that so-called hookup culture, which I'm sure does exist on some level, but it's not as prevalent as people think. And so there, I certainly interviewed young women on you know, campuses of liberal arts universities. I mean, just about every major liberal arts university, say in the D.C. area, is majority female now. And some of them would talk about not, you know, having boyfriends that much, or they would talk about going to other campuses. There's this kind of constant restless movement from campus to campus, hoping that, you know, maybe there'll be some guys on, you know, on another campus. So I think in some cases, maybe there's less romantic activity than some people would like. But I interviewed some young women who graduated from UNC Chapel Hill, and they had had quite satisfactory, dating lives and sex lives in which they felt quite empowered. And one of the arguments, again, that I make in the book is that ultimately this is a good thing for women to be educated, to be economically powerful in their relationships. It gives them more time once they graduate to look around and to meet a guy who's right for them, to have different romantic partners, different sexual partners. Interestingly, I interviewed a group of young women in Atlanta where like in many American cities, young women are out earning young men, at least single women are. And they were having a great time, and they also felt in their relationships like they didn't have to make certain accommodations for their boyfriends. They explicitly said, you know, if he wants me to wear more makeup, if he wants me to lose weight, I'm not going to do it. One of them said, you know, I have a rule. If you thought I was hot when you met me, you don't get to change the rules later. So, you know, there's this kind of old notion that relationships and marriage are a deal. Actually, Simone de Beauvoir referred to it as a deal. And the old deal was that men brought money and women brought a whole constellation of other things. They brought beauty, or they brought sexual services, or they brought childbearing services, or they brought domestic skills. And, you know, up to a certain point, I think that's true. You do have to bring something to a relationship. And what we're seeing is because women now are economically empowered, men are having to bring some different things to the deal. You know, maybe being more sexually accommodating, certainly doing dishes. And all of these women were very focused on finding permanent partners who would help out around the house. And there was also some suggestion that the women expected the men to bring some beauty. There was one woman I talked to who was kind of obsessed with the fact that her boyfriend was gaining weight, and she was kind of obsessed checking his jean size and becoming increasingly dissatisfied with it. So they were kind of picky in that regard. So it's really interesting. I mean, but at the same time, they were also very uncertain how to wear their affluence in public. And would sometimes, I talked to a surprising number of women who would lie when they went out on the dating market about what they did. I interviewed some young women lawyers in Texas who were going out on the town in San Antonio one summer. And after a couple of nights of telling guys they were lawyers and finding that the guys became sort of argumentative and wanted to talk about politics, they decided that they would just say they were cosmetologists. So they did. And they said, we had a great time because these guys didn't want to talk to us about what we did, and they didn't want to argue with us or ask us, do you never want to have children? We just went and had a great time. And over again, actually, I talked to women who, at least in initial encounters, would actually lie about what they did. And I was sorry to hear that, because studies show that, that young men are much more likely to rate financial prospects as an important criterion in a partner than they used to be. Domestic skills used to rank really high for men in talking about somebody they'd like to marry, but financial prospects has risen and domestic skills has plummeted. So I think, young women shouldn't be so shy about their success and so unwilling to acknowledge it.
Well, maybe because of this, or maybe as part of both women and men, and increasingly women feeling financially independent, you also say that marriage as a partnership is really starting to change. And you talk about this event in the summer of 2001 where you've got the Census Bureau and the National Center for Health Statistics and all these organizations coming together for a conference trying to figure out, what do we do with all these households where people are not married? Either they're single, they're cohabitating romantically, they're cohabitating non-romantically. Yeah. How do we think about what the future is starting to bring?
Right. Yeah. And they were specifically concerned with, how do you count couples these days? How do you define, who's in a partnership? And how do you compare that against, it was easy, I guess, once upon a time for census takers. Either you were married or you were single. But, now how do you describe these pairings? We know that, about half of adult Americans now are married and half aren't. And some of those have been married or will be married. I mean, we know that people are waiting longer to marry than they ever have before, but they're also cohabitating in greater rates or cohabiting, than ever before. And we know now that, 40% of children who are born now are born to unmarried women. Some of them are cohabiting, some of them aren't. And so how do you make sense of these new households? And obviously there are lots of reasons why this is happening. But when I was trying to think it through, I was struck by this this quote I ran across in 1868 in the London Times when the British Parliament was considering giving property rights to married women. I mean, it's really useful to remember that for hundreds and hundreds of years, women, when they got married, had lost, all right to their earnings or their property. They were disempowered in marriage. And the paper was talking about how important this was for a happy marriage and for marriage to continue to exist, that it was important for one member to be subordinate and one member to be basically dominant and the household authority. And they said, if women were to be able to keep their own wages and have property in marriage, what is to prevent her from going where she likes and doing what she pleases?
Fascinating.
And the fact is that if women can support themselves and if they look around and they don't see men who seem like they're going to bring something to the deal, then a certain proportion of women are not going to marry.
So if you're looking at a country, which we are now, where just over half of American adults are married, in 1960, births to single mothers was very low, about 5% of births.
Yeah.
Now it's 41%, and cohabitation rates have doubled just since 1990. Now, you've got people, David Brooks from the New York Times, Charles Murray, who recently wrote a book about the coming apart of white America, who have really said, this is a serious problem, the decline of marriage. And I wonder, do you see this as a serious problem? Is this hurting the fabric of American society?
That's a really good question. I mean, okay, studies show, I think, that, married people on balance are healthier. I think it's fair to say that for kids, I'm sure there are people who would disagree with this, but, to grow up in a two-parent household, if it's a happy, functional household, is probably ideal. It's also, I'm the parent, working parent of two children. It is helpful, to have somebody to relieve that burden and a partner. You know, I don't know. I think there's a certain percentage of the population that is maybe happy to be unpartnered. And it's good. It's good for women that marriage isn't the only kind of path to success anymore. I mean, you look at for people who, like me, are aficionados of Downton Abbey, you look at the three daughters in that series, and marriage is really the only acceptable future for them. They're disinherited and they have to marry, and if you didn't marry back then, you were a failure. And it's a good thing that is no longer the cultural mindset. I mean, for sure. But on the other hand, if there are women and men who would ideally like to be married, and for whatever reason it just doesn't seem viable, then we need to find a way to fix that. You know, particularly in the working class, I think where men are suffering from the loss of high-paying manufacturing jobs and can't, you know, facing really high unemployment rates and are disadvantaged, you know, both in terms of just daily living and as potential mates, then that is certainly not an ideal situation.
Yeah, I wonder how you fit in the idea of the ascension of women with this issue of class. I mean, it seems, and maybe this is just anecdotal, but in more affluent suburbs, for example, that there are probably lots more stay-at-home moms than there are in more middle-class and poorer places because moms simply have to work. So is there a cultural divide, both in terms of the attitude towards getting married, the actual document of marriage, and the issue of staying at home versus working as a woman?
Yeah, you know, it does seem anecdotally in affluent suburbs. I live in D.C., you know, that there's a high proportion of stay-at-home moms. But I'm not sure that that's true across the board. I mean, the statistics show that if you have a college degree, you're more likely to work than if you don't. And that, you know, many stay-at-home moms are actually lower-income women who can't get the kind of child care that would, you know, that it would make it worthwhile for them to take that fairly low-paying job. So I'm not sure it's true, actually, that stay-at-home moms are more likely to be affluent women, because the better educated you are, the more likely you are to be in the workforce. You know, but I do think there's a class element of this. I mean, certainly sociologists have shown that in the African-American community, one of the disincentives to marriage has been the fact that African-American men have really suffered in this economy and in the decline of the manufacturing sector, and that this has disrupted marriage patterns in the African-American community. I mean, one of the interesting just kind of historical facts that I learned in my reporting is that traditionally, even back as far as the 1950s, African-American women were more likely to have a college degree than men were. And that's because there was an economic payoff for them. If you were a man in the African-American community in the 50s and 60s, you were going to face discrimination, but you could, without a college degree, get, you know, a reasonably well-paying job in manufacturing or industry. And if you did get a college degree, you weren't going to see an economic payoff. You weren't going to be able to rise high in the white-collar world. Yet for women, there was so much discrimination that, you know, you really needed a college degree. Then you could become a teacher. And if you didn't have a degree, then you were pretty much consigned to really low-paying manufacturing work or domestic, you know, domestic services. So there's been this academic imbalance. And then, of course, men, African-American men, have suffered acutely in the decline of manufacturing and the economic downturn. So, you know, there has been a real effect on marriage rates. And now that's, you know, that's happening in the population as a whole. So again, I mean, that's not an ideal situation for anybody.
And you talk about Howard University, which is this prestigious, historically black college where, and this floored me, now almost 70% of the students are female.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I know. I agree. As I said, the imbalance has always been there, and it's, you know, there are interesting, I think, real reasons, at least historically, why this used to be the case in terms of people making decisions based on you know, what kind of work would be available for them if they did get a college degree. But the imbalance has grown, and I think it's fair to say needs to be addressed.
And finally, I'm wondering, you talk a little bit about this in the book, but we've talked about sort of a class divide and maybe a bit of a racial divide. Are there national divides? Are there countries that are dealing with the ascension, a future in which more women are simply in the workplace, heads of households, that kind of thing? Are they dealing with it differently than we are in the U.S.?
Yes. And in my book, I have a chapter. I mean, I wish I could have done more, but I did spend a summer in Japan where this is it's a problem, and in you know, it's what they call a marriage crisis, and there were some sort of funny aspects of it. I mean, that's a very traditional society in terms of you know, the so-called separate spheres. Women traditionally were housewives and kind of ruled the household, and men worked insanely long hours as salarymen for corporations and in business. And actually, there's a word for husband that I think translate as big sack of garbage, basically. You know, the men would come home and they would sit around and really not contribute at all in terms of housework. But now the situation has radically changed, so that, you know, women are getting better educated than men in Japan, in South Korea, and yet they're struggling with these very traditional expectations in terms not only of housework, but sort of care of the extended family. And so sociologists have argued that women are deciding not to marry, that they're using their earnings basically to buy themselves out of a marriage contract that just looks very disadvantageous to them. But but at the same time, when I was over there, there was this, you know, dating agencies and marriage agencies are just being inundated by women who do want a partner and who are trying to kind of make their way in a new society. And one of the things that they do is they specifically try to teach men how to talk to women. And they have, like, dating advisors who will sit down with a guy and sort of do role-playing. And they'll say to him, you know, now that you're not bringing the economic resources to the relationship, you got to bring something else, like conversational ability. You've got to learn how to woo her. And so they'll teach men, as one woman said, you know, you can't talk one-sidedly for half an hour or an hour. You have to learn to listen to her.
Some finishing school, some etiquette.
Exactly. Finishing schools for men. And they actually do have government classes for husbands to try to teach them how to, you know, participate more in the household.
A fascinating discussion. We have been talking about the role of women, how it's changing, and how this could reshape American society and countries all around the world. I've been speaking with Liza Mundy, the author of The Richer Sex, How the New Majority of Female Breadwinners is Transforming Sex, Love, and Family. Liza Mundy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Emily Rooney is back in Studio 3. What's on tap, Emily?
Well, as I'm sure you've heard, the Red Sox have a new manager. John Farrell says he's humbled and honored to be the 46th manager of the Boston Red Sox.
I've heard. Is he a good choice? I don't know a lot about baseball, so you have to help me out here.
I wouldn't have known him until I saw him today. He said all the right things. Let's see if he can do all the right things.
I look forward to hearing the segment.
All right.
I'm Kara Miller.
I'm Emily Rooney, and this is Boston Public Radio.